Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. You know, as Latinos, we most often don't see ourselves reflected accurately or fairly in the media, besides Latino USA, of course. And that's true for other groups as well. Let me give you some examples. On the front page of the New York Times, men are quoted 3 times more often than women. More than 3/4 of the entire news workforce for TV is white. Almost 80% of all characters from the top films of 2012 were white. And of those white characters, 70% were men. Now, I could go on and on, but the fact is, white men dominate the media in this country. And that can make many people, especially women of color, feel like we don't belong in the media. But that's starting to change. Take, for instance, BuzzFeed. In many ways, it's the future of millennial media. Recently, BuzzFeed launched a slightly more inventive section of their site called Ideas. And as its editor, they chose 23-year-old Aisha Siddiqui. Siddiqui is not Latina, but the issues that matter to her matter to all of us, like confronting racism, sexism, and problems of being seen as the other. We wanted to hear why she so boldly asked, "Why not me?" Aisha Siddiqui joins us in our studio here in Harlem to talk about the changing face of new media. Welcome to Latino USA, Aisha.
Thank you.
So you were born in England. When you were about 3 or 4 years old, you moved to Pakistan, and you're there when you're until you're about 6, and then you moved to the United States, right?
Yes.
And I have this image of you in a house with like a courtyard, and you running around, and someone cooking food, and lots of sound and nature. Am I right?
You're absolutely right.
Oh, it sounds delicious. Now, from there, you then moved to Hartford, Connecticut?
That's right.
What was that like?
I mean, we moved around a lot, but it was always to very white, very homogenous suburbs. And those are the formative experiences that shaped the issues I, you know, grew to really care about now as an adult.
I mean, there's a lot around identity, a lot around power shifting, a lot around the media, invisibility. Tell me about that connection. The headstrong young Pakistani girl who then becomes a headstrong young American woman, journalist, editor, influencer.
Well, it was really a process of rediscovering that original headstrong young girl that for most of my time in this country was not allowed to be that way or to really have a space and voice. And it was the openness and availability of Twitter and the internet. And when I joined Twitter, it wasn't in anticipation of any sort of audience. It was just a platform to which no expectations or prestige or anything, you know, or even requirements were attached. You just got on and said what you wanted to say. And that certainly was a very significant moment in rediscovering my voice, absolutely, and sort of developing a vocabulary to name all of the experiences I'd grown up with, and then discovering how common they are to many young people of color across America.
So what specifics of vocabulary are you talking about? Because you're basically saying there is an invisible language that the mainstream media, overwhelmingly run by white men over 50, mm-hmm. What's the vocabulary that they're missing that you got and that people who follow you also get?
Well, to begin with, just the basic facts of racism. And, you know, the ability to name something is an opportunity to exercise a level of power over it. And that can be an incredible balm in retrospect to apply to all of the, you know, aggression or hostility or just general, you know, unwelcomeness that we as, you know, young people in America, people of color may encounter, particularly immigrants, South Asians, and to return to those experiences with, you know, the power to name them for what they were and what they are, and to name whiteness and to name hegemonic powers is definitely the first step towards confronting them and challenging them, really.
You wrote an article about a pilot. It was ABC Family's Alice in Arabia. Your article was called Alice is in Arabia and the rest of us hold our breath. You basically wrote about how the show was going to be offensive. I mean, it was based on a little American girl that gets kidnapped. So already it's just like, you're kidding. This is the, and somehow we're supposed to be excited about what she's going to learn about Arabia, quote unquote. The ABC Family ends up canceling the show. a lot of people were probably very upset about that, but it does say a lot about precisely the power that you're saying you now name.
You know, it wasn't something that I would have imagined to be possible even a year ago, but it was such an incredible story to watch unfold. We got a hold of the script, actually, from our LA office, and Rega Jahu wrote a piece. She was able to, you know, go through and explain all of the problems that we'd anticipated ended up being, in fact, a reality written into the pilot. And so what was interesting about what happened with Alice in Arabia is that our sentiments and reactions were not particularly unique. Had this show been proposed in 1990, 2007, the people who felt the way they did would have felt similarly. I mean, there are very familiar archaic tropes that the show was planning on invoking. What was unique is that our frustration was allowed to be collective because it was allowed to be seen across this platform that made it visible not only to everyone else, but to each other. And so now it was no longer, you know, someone living in a suburb of Arkansas or, you know, an activist in New York. It was everyone seeing in real time at once that our reactions and our frustrations, they manifest in like so many, in such at such high volume. To be able to harness that volume, you have to be aware of it first. And that's what we were. There was the Alice in Arabia hashtag on Twitter that connected so many voices, calling out not only the stereotypes of the show, but what it would mean for the rest of us to have to live with them.
In other words, we already have an identity.
Exactly, yeah.
What would happen if you actually listened to us about our identity, and then we wouldn't have to spend all our time saying, no, that's not who we are?
Absolutely, because to consistently only be in a position to where you're responding to stereotypes, you're legitimizing them in the discourse, and you are accepting that it's a very unempowered position to always being say, oh, this is what we aren't, instead of an opportunity to show who we really are. And that we is a multitude. And I mean, especially as a Muslim woman, the burden of constantly myth-busting.
And not having a television show.
Absolutely.
Like, if you had your own television show called Mythbusters and you were being paid a nice big salary, that might be fun.
Sure, right. But we don't have that. And it's simply not effective. I mean, we've been trying to shatter stereotypes, which is like the common phrase, like, oh, Muslim women shattering stereotypes, Muslim woman doing X despite being a Muslim woman. That's the narrative, that whatever it is we accomplish as Muslim women, it's in spite of our identities rather than through them or because of them. And so my stance on that is very much, if, you know, myth busting was effective, we would have gotten rid of them a long time ago.
So when you think about the response to the kinds of pieces that you put out, which again have a lot to do with power, media, is it mostly love that you're getting back?
It is. It's been incredibly gratifying how well received these, you know, inaugural pieces from BuzzFeed Ideas have been. Just the amount of actual gratitude. People have been emailing me, sending messages and comments about how much they've valued some of the conversations that Ideas has been able to host so far, because they were conversations that they honestly, like me, didn't imagine possible even months ago. We did a roundtable discussion on the Mindy Project and were able to talk about experiences and subjects that would have been so valuable to me as a young South Asian girl growing up in America. But it's been just as moving to be able to offer that to others. And, you know, some of the messages on Twitter and on the article from not just South Asian girls, but even, you know, Black men have emailed me about that piece and how much it spoke to them, Asian Americans, everyone. And it's so exciting to be a part of that, of a part of determining what is now possible.
It is a known fact that you are a huge fan of Kanye West.
That's right.
And you use Kanye West as a kind of prism with which to look through at a bunch of issues. Why Kanye? And is what attracts you to him the fact that he talks openly about learning to believe in the power of our voice and of our narrative?
Absolutely. Kanye West is such an interesting figure for the absolute rage he inspires in so many others. And regardless of how people feel about his music or his celebrity, it has always been fascinating to me how people feel about his ego and what right he has to talk about himself and his talent the way he does. And so often that, you know, arbitration of how much of his own genius he's allowed to be aware of parallels what many young people, especially people of color in America, face in terms of owning their own talents and voice and feeling entitled to spaces that we're taught we should just barely be grateful to be allowed in. And that is why I find Kanye West to be such an inspiring figure. It's so fascinating to me that someone who has earned so many accolades of that genre, he's won every award, his albums have gone number one, they have been so massively successful. His talent and vision are undeniably historically significant even, yet still he's considered to overvalue himself. And as he said in his, now infamous Zane Lowe interview, if you're a fan of Kanye West, you're not a fan of me, you're a fan of yourself. His self-presentation is really a subversive practice of how to value yourself in a society and system that is so intent on determining your value for you.
There are a lot of people who I think don't even recognize or want to see the kind of amazing shift that is happening. As you said, it's happening by the hour, The change in this country. We're a part of that change. Even this conversation is part of that change. Are you optimistic about the future, or do you think that, you know, I mean, there's been hate crimes that have occurred in just recently, so...
I don't think I'd, you know, be able to do my job without a modicum of optimism. So much of what I didn't even dare to be optimistic about is now firmly a part of our reality, and there are trends that are now inevitable. So that is exciting, and, you know, the world is changing whether people are comfortable with it or not.
Thanks so much for joining us in the conversation, Aisha.
Thank you for having me.
Aisha Siddiqui is the editor of BuzzFeed Ideas. You can follow her on Twitter @PushingHoops.